When the president talks to God, are the conversations brief or long? Does he ask to rape our women's rights and send poor farm kids off to die? Does God suggest an oil hike when the president talks to God? When the president talks to God, are the consonants all hard or soft? Is he resolute all down the line? Is every issue black or white? Does what God say ever change his mind when the president talks to God? When the president talks to God, does he fake that drawl or merely nod? Agree which convicts should be killed, where prisons should be built and filled, which voter fraud must be concealed when the president talks to God? When the president talks to God, I wonder which one plays the better cop. We should find some jobs, the ghetto's broke. No, they're lazy, George, I say we don't. Just give them more liquor stores and dirty coke. That's what God recommends. When the president talks to God, do they drink near beer and go play golf while they pick which countries to invade, which Muslim souls still can be saved? I guess God just calls a spade when the president talks to God. When the president talks to God, does he ever think that maybe he's not? That voice is just inside his head when he kneels next to the presidential bed? Does he ever smell his own bullshit when the president talks to God? I doubt it. Kids, I doubt it.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman, and if you're just joining us, we're listening to American Spine Then and Now, which includes Andrew Basevich, Stephen Kinzer, Evan Thomas, and is moderated by Brian Bender.
Let me ask each of you a question, yes or no, and then I'll have a follow-up. Evan, first, do you think the United States government spies more now on its own citizens than it did at the height of the Cold War, or at the height of this fear of a domestic communist menace, along with other things?
Thomas.
Collects more information. Whether it abuses it, I don't know.
Stephen?
Kinzer.
I think certainly it's spying more on more people. I think back in the 50s, there was also this sense that you had to watch people's behaviors. If people were not religious, if people didn't go to school, if people had kind of offbeat lifestyles, didn't fit the social paradigm, there was a danger that they might also slip out of the political paradigm. So there was much more focus, I think, on bohemianism and all sorts of unorthodox behavior that was thought of as a clue to dangerous political thinking. I don't think we have that anymore, but I do think we have a much larger volume of data collection, no doubt.
Basevich.
Absolutely, yes. The answer is yes.
But Stephen makes an interesting point. You have this massive amount of information, this metadata, which, as Evan pointed out, is very difficult to analyze. It's very difficult to do anything with. Is it your belief, Andy, that not only does the U.S. spy more, but it potentially infringes on civil liberties more? What I'm trying to get at is, it's one thing to have the phone numbers, it's one thing to have it somewhere on a hard drive, but do you believe that there are analysts out there, intelligence officials out there, that are actually delving into that information in an unwarranted way, similar to what Stephen's describing, looking at the behavior of a pre-hippie person in the late 50s?
Basevich.
Yes.
I dare say, and I don't know this, okay, I don't know this, but I dare say that there is a list of, what should we call them, suspects living within the United States of America. That list is probably 2 million names long, and that those individuals are specifically singled out as we plow through all the data that the NSA and other agencies collect. They're sifting through that data in order to understand what the people on that list are thinking or doing, and that the justification for that is the mandate to prevent a recurrence of 9/11, I just have no doubt that's going.
Thomas,
well, we have from the 50s and 60s with a perspective of history, we have a lot of horror stories of bad stuff that happened, of lives ruined, of homosexuals thrown out of the State Department, of socialist school teachers being run out of their jobs, of Martin Luther King being bugged, Hoover keeping secret files. We have all these horror stories from that period. We don't have the horror stories from this period yet. I don't know. I mean, maybe Andy's right, and there are a lot of horror stories, and we just don't know them. I think that's what you're suggesting. But I'm waiting for those. Maybe I shouldn't be
complacent. Base a bitch.
Well, maybe I'm too cynical about the way government agencies function. Why did the FBI engage in those activities in the 50s and the 60s? Activities, in retrospect, we would say were pernicious, wrong, unconstitutional, and never should have happened, because agencies like the FBI at the time believed that they were performing an important public service by identifying radicals like Martin Luther King, who had some kind of association with communists, and therefore, from their perspective, from the agency's perspective, there was a justification. And I speculate that much the same dynamic works today.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com. And now back to American Spine Then and Now with Basevich, Kinzer, Thomas, and Bender. Thomas.
Could be we just haven't seen the...
Correct.
Waiting for Woodward and Bernstein to write the story.
Well, it seems to me that one difference is that some of the horror stories that have come to light through government files, government records, the historians like you have written about, it's pretty clear that a lot of those activities were outright unlawful. They were illegal. They were violations of the Constitution. But today, you don't get a sense, and it may just simply be because we don't know all of the details, but you don't get a sense that what is going on is unlawful, in the sense that the NSA's powers of gathering this metadata, this relatively few times where the secret FISA courts have weighed in, have all been authorized. At least it seems that way. I mean, Congress authorized it. They may not have known what they were authorizing, and it's pretty clear that many of them did not realize that they had given this blanket power to the NSA. But would you agree that there is a difference in the sense that back then it's clear now, with hindsight, that these things were against the law?
But it wasn't so clear then. Black bag jobs, bugging and tapping was legal up until the late 60s. The courts didn't turn against it till the late 60s. There was a wide latitude for national security spying given investigative agencies until the courts started to turn against it in the late
60s.
And I don't know why you would assume that in the post 9/11 period there is not illegal activity. I mean, if you
tick off
things, no, things that we know about: extraordinary rendition, torture, the killing of Americans without due process. Now, maybe you can find some clever lawyer somewhere, probably working in the Justice Department, that can concoct an argument about why these things are in fact legal. But from a common sense perspective, it strikes me that they're all beyond the pale. So that's behavior that most people could, I think, readily identify as wrong. Why would you assume that in the secret world of the NSA, they behave themselves.
Ginsburg.
I have a somewhat different perspective. I don't think that it would take a very Justice Department lawyer to justify those things. I think all those things are legal. This extraordinary rendition, what do they call enhanced interrogation, drone strikes. Our laws are so malleable, they can be stretched to cover anything. It is unrealistic to believe that there could be any serious legal framework imposed by Congress in the constellation that we have in Washington today that will have any effective break on what these intelligence agencies are doing. It's not necessarily that they're doing things that are legal. It's that by the way we construe everything from secret presidential findings to clauses of the Patriot Act, just about anything the federal government wants to do to protect Americans, by its own definition, is legal.
Thomas.
With this exception, CIA officials are often risk-averse these days. They're afraid of being dragged before congressional committees. They have lawyer's insurance. I mean, a lot of people in the CIA get insurance policies to have a lawyer for when they are forced to testify. And the CIA was very... The CIA, you can track it over the years. In the 50s, super aggressive. Bay of Pigs, a little bit less aggressive. Builds up again in the Vietnam War. Church Committee, oh my God, CIA becomes a lot less aggressive. But Reagan comes in, more aggressive. Iran-Contra after that, less aggressive. 9/11, more aggressive. And so their attitudes inside do change, and their aggressiveness does change depending on the political surround, what the courts are doing, what Congress is doing. And so even though you can stretch those laws, there are periods of time when the people actually running the CIA are pretty cautious. I mean, interestingly, before 9/11, the Air Force developed a drone. But these high officials in the CIA, the head of operations there, did not want to put a missile on that drone, because he didn't want to get the CIA back in the assassination business. And one reason why we were unable to kill bin Laden was that in 98, 99, 2000, was there was a lot of talk about, gee, should we put a missile on a drone and go after him that way? And Jim Pabot, the guy who was running the operations office, said, no, we don't want to be in that business. After 9/11, they immediately got into that business.
Ginsburg.
A couple of months ago, the director of national intelligence, General Clapper, sat in front of a Senate committee under oath and was asked by a senator, are your intelligence agencies collecting any kind of data about millions or hundreds of millions of Americans? His answer was, no, sir. Later on, after the Snowden revelations proved that he was lying, he said that he had only tried to give the least untrue answer possible. We indicted and prosecuted and convicted a former CIA director, Richard Helms, for those exact same two words, no, sir. When he was being grilled about being ambassador to Iran, they asked about his time in the CIA and said, did the CIA have any involvement in overthrowing President Pinochet, President Allende in Chile? He said, no, sir. When that was found out to be a lie, he was indicted, prosecuted, and convicted. He later said he bore his conviction as a badge of honor. General Clapper is still in his job. So that shows me something about the level of congressional oversight.
Thomas.
And also the national mood. When Helms got convicted,
yeah,
that was right after Watergate, and we were in a mood to clamp down on official abuse.
Ginsburg.
Which makes me add to this point. It's not them. It's us. Don't blame it on them. We are all complicit in this. We're all partners.
We'll shift gears a little bit. To what I think at least history shows is another influence in the intelligence gathering business. We talked about the threat, the perceived threat, which, as we have talked about, can oftentimes be blinding. But I was struck in both Evan and Stephen's books about the extent to which sort of corporate interests influenced America's spy game. Particularly in the early Cold War, you talked about the overthrow of the leader in Guatemala in the 1950s. I thought it was fascinating the way Stephen details the role of the Boston-based United Fruit Company, which obviously had a lot at stake in Guatemala, if a leftist leader was going to take over and nationalize some of these rich farmlands. And I know, Andy, you've written about this as well. You've written about the defense industrial base, defense companies having a major influence in how the threat is perceived, because obviously the bigger the threat, the more weapons you need, the bigger military you need. So if all of you could, from your perspective, talk a little bit about how you see that corporate influence or financial incentive of American corporations or international corporations to beef up the threat, to constantly be looking for a security threat.
Thomas.
Well, it never goes away. If you take a cab or drive from Dulles Airport into Washington, you pass one new building after another. And I always think that those are the buildings that Osama bin Laden built because they are full of defense contractors and intelligence contractors who had an absolute open spigot after 9/11. Congress just took the lid off of intelligence spending and defense spending after 9/11. They just blew it out, and you could get any contractor could get a contract, and those buildings are full of people doing, I think, redundant and often unnecessary work, maybe good work, but a lot of overkill, because we were so scared after 9/11. Now, that funding, I think, is finally slowing down or maybe drying up a little bit, but boy, we spent billions and billions and billions of dollars, and all those buildings are full of people who have a really real vested interest in keeping it going and are pretty good at lobbying and keeping those contracts going.
Ginsburg.
We have a foreign policy that's largely based on promoting the interests of American business. It's not that the intelligence apparatus is aimed at supporting corporate interests in the world. It supports American foreign policy. But American foreign policy is often shaped to promote American corporate interests, to promote American business. This is not so unusual. But the whole idea of corporate globalism and liberal internationalism ultimately is based on opening up markets and sources of resources for the United States. So there's no doubt that the desire to increase America's economic power and support our corporations abroad is a part of our intelligence gathering. We've seen from some of the Snowden documents that U.S. intelligence has been used to try to find out the negotiating strategies that foreign corporations are going to be using in their negotiations with American corporations. But what I find really interesting is there's been a little blowback on this one, and that is that the corporations like Google and the other big information companies have gone to President Obama personally and told him, we're losing business in other countries because nobody wants to send their emails through our companies anymore. So you've got to do something to assure Americans that we're not mining this data. And since he's not able to do that, our foreign policy, particularly in the intelligence area, is harming at least some parts of our economy.
Basevich.
Yeah, I think I'd agree with Stephen. I mean, I myself would have a difficult time imagining that President Obama would sign off on an effort to overthrow some government in order to promote the interests of a banana company, as was once the case. That said, the larger purpose of the national security apparatus is to promote what we might call, I guess, a neoliberal worldview, a world of capitalist economies, a world that is open to the workings of free enterprise, a world that is increasingly integrated in terms of the way information flows, the way ideas are exchanged, and that in some respects, that vision of a neoliberal international political economic order is the very foundation of what the intelligence community and the entire national security apparatus is all about.
Thomas.
But Stephen touched on something interesting about Google. There is this pushback from Silicon Valley against being used in this way. And a lot of people in those companies, at least present themselves as libertarian and anti-big government and not liking Big Brother, and yet they have the technical skills to do all this. I sort of wonder how that's going to play out. I'm sure that, yes, those big technology companies, many of them want the government contracts, but also they don't want to be used because can be bad for business. As Stephen said, people don't want to route their phones through somebody if they think it's going to go right into the U.S. government's computers. But also, just ideologically, the people who run those companies are not exactly big government types.
Before we maybe open it up for questions, everyone up here is a historian. You've certainly written quite a few books about national security history. I'm curious, looking ahead, if you could handicap a little bit how difficult or not so difficult it will be to write the history of the war on terrorism. Obviously, there is a lot that remains secret. We don't know how much remains secret. And as a journalist covering this on a day-to-day basis, I often think that unlike the Cold War, which did end at some point, allowing the U.S. government to reveal lots of things that it did not want to reveal at the time, the war on terrorism is described as lasting forever, or, you know, we don't know when it's going to end. And I wonder if that is setting up a set of circumstances where the government, the CIA, the NSA, various other national security agencies can basically just use a blanket excuse, we don't have to release any of this stuff because we're still waging war against Islamic extremism. So I'm curious what your view is. Not to mention that the paper trail is now also a digital trail, which, at least from where I sit, there doesn't seem to be much confidence that we know who's keeping that stuff, who is maintaining those hard drives, and how does that relate to a place like this, the National Archives, which presumably someday is supposed to help the public understand what really happened, who was making some of these decisions that were behind closed doors.
Thomas.
Well, there are a hell of a lot of emails. Somebody's got them.
You think someone has them? You think they're being...
Yeah, they're somewhere. They exist. I mean, whether the National Archives will get them is a different question. But these things do exist, and they have a way of sort of popping up. Nothing ever goes away. So in theory, the evidence is there to be gotten. Now, the government's desire to keep secrets is eternal. They're still declassifying stuff from World War II. You know, it's unbelievable. I deal with this all the time, writing about the 50s and 60s, and it's amazing how much stuff is still anything with the word nuclear in it is still classified or just gradually being declassified. In theory, 25, 30 years out, they let it out. In fact, no, because every agency's got to sign off on it, and the presumption is to keep it, not let it out. So the government desire to keep secrets is eternal.
Ginzer.
In 1953, as I mentioned earlier, the United States overthrew the government of Iran. There has been there's a huge gap in material that's been released of U.S. correspondence and material about this. The CIA's Historians Committee has put together the volume, but the CIA has refused to release it. That was in 1953. I think it's because, I'm just speculating, I think it's because they fear that revelations about what things we did there would reverberate now and make relations between the U.S. and Iran more difficult. In 1960, with the approval of President Eisenhower, the United States assisted in the execution of the Prime Minister of the Congo, Patrice Lumumba. We still don't know what happened. There's a whole volume in the CIA and State Department documents that has never been released. That was 1960. So I would extrapolate from that the history of what is happening now will not be written in the lifetime of anyone in this room in any complete way.
Basevich.
Well, I would agree that in the digital age, there are going to be challenges in capturing the history. As long as the global war on terrorism continues, that provides an excuse to refuse to declassify and reveal things. But in another sense, the real challenges of writing history are going to be what they always have been, and that is trying to reconstruct and to understand the thinking of the people who are involved in making pivotal decisions. I mean, here in this library right now, I mean, I myself still puzzle over what logic led President Kennedy to sign off on the overthrow of President Diem, leading to President Diem's assassination, and an unbelievable catastrophe that we call the war in Vietnam. Given everything else that we know about what Kennedy was thinking at that time related to matters of war and peace after his American University speech in the wake of the Cuban Missile Crisis, what was it that caused him to say, yeah, that sounds like a good idea? And there are really no documents that give us an answer to that. And frankly, if there were documents, I'm not sure I'd even trust them. Because what you really want to do is to understand what he was thinking at the time. And that's always going to prove to be very elusive.
Well, maybe with that, we've talked about an hour. We can open it to the audience. If there are questions, I will ask you to step to one of the mics, one in this aisle, one in that aisle. And maybe keep it to a question as opposed to a speech. And no follow-ups.
And now for something completely different.